Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, it's a good week for Irish cinema. I talk to Eva Burthistle and Hazel Doop about their new movie, Kathleen Is Here. Peter Coonan stars in King Frankie, a great new Irish film directed and written by Dermot Malone. And both of them join me in studio. And further afield, cinema internationally involves Transformers 1. And Brian Lloyd will be here to tell us all about it and more besides. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com with the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well. I'm slightly out of breath there. I ran into a studio. One of those days where you're rushing around and you got to stop and think, you know, nothing's that important. Surely, an interview with Selena Gomez on Zoom? Haha, said he name-droppingly. More of that to follow in the coming weeks ahead. I have to tell you quickly, this week, last week I was thinking about a new cat in our house. A couple of people got in touch saying, what did you expect? Of course cats are going to poo. Got a new car this week. Not a new car, it's years old, but a new car for us. And I had this, and I'm happy to name it without any brand whatever, but I had a Volkswagen Golf that we had since like the year my son was born, like 2012, it became my car. And that has taken me around the country. I even had it on a ferry once overseas and I swore by it. I'm speaking in the past tense because, you know, in the age of recycling and all that, I was hanging on to it. But it got to the point where there was an engine light that a mechanic couldn't get off. Some of the dashboard wasn't working. The straw finally broke two Saturdays ago, and I was driving into here actually, and it was about 6:30 in the morning, and it was an unexpectedly frosty morning, and the heater stopped working. So there I was with a window open, driving along the motorway, freezing my backside off, thinking, it's time, dear Golf. It was a, kind of like a relationship you don't want to end, but it was time. So bye-bye, dear Golf, wherever you are. I know no one's driving you. You're probably at the bottom of a scrap heap. Thanks for the memories. Now, this week in TV, I was watching this.
I don't normally do these kind of speeches, but this feels like a big moment, and if it all turns to shit, I might not see any of you again. You're f***ing useless. The lot of you. Working with you has been the lowest point in a disappointing career. Right. Cartwright, you're with me. Wait, what do we do? Well, try not to get caught for as long as you can. My money's on about 30 minutes.
Well, we can try and save Hassan.
Well, that'd be a sure way to get him killed. Go lock yourselves in a toilet somewhere.
Yes, now that is the wonderful Gary Oldman from Slow Horses on Apple TV. I briefly mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when I said it had done well at the Emmys and I had only started watching it. I've now watched off, and my God, is it good TV? Yes, it is good TV. Gary Oldman, who you heard there, plays Jackson Lamb, who is the most world-weary man you've ever come across, who's in charge of the Slow Horses, who are this group of disaffected, despondent, displaced MI5 operatives who have been moved to a place called Slough House for indiscretions. So if you've done something bad in MI5 or something that the powers that be don't approve of, they move you to Slough House. So there's all these different characters who are intelligence operatives who have baggage from their careers and from their lives. And in charge of them is Gary Oldman, who is just doesn't want to be there either. And there's a myriad of things going on in his life and his own defences, but he's absolutely hilarious. And he's also a very good spy. And he's actually very good at being in charge of these Slow Horses. And even though they're on the periphery of things in terms of intelligence agency work, they end up getting involved through various reasons in serious, big missions and threats to national security. It has a stellar cast. Kristen Scott Thomas, Jack Loudon is in there. It's absolutely brilliant. And it's, you know, a spy series, but it's just the right side of not being boring. Sometimes spy series, to my mind, they're too hard to follow. Now, maybe it's my own limited capabilities, but I just find I'm tangled up in knots and I'm not sure what's going on. The spying and the espionage and the just the plot in this is followable and you feel smart watching it. It is absolutely brilliant and utterly bingeable. It is on Apple TV. It's based on a series of novels by a guy called Mick Herron. There's four seasons there. They've greenlit a fifth one. Here's a bold statement. It's the greatest role Gary Oldman has ever played. And that's saying something. Let me know if you disagree wildly, or indeed if you've watched it. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now, let's talk about this.
Kathleen Carroll Dunn. No next of kin. It might feel strange being back here, Kathleen. If you make different choices, things could be a lot better for you.
Hiya. We've just moved in. I'm Dee.
Hi.
You making any friends?
One.
It's weird now being in the house on my own.
If you ever need anything.
Thanks.
Are we taking in waves and strays now?
She's just lonely. I couldn't have managed on my own at her age.
I like your necklace.
It's supposed to make your wishes come true.
You don't know the first thing about her, Dee.
Have I something to be concerned about, Kathleen?
Now, that is a clip from Kathleen Is Here, a movie that is out next weekend. So that's the 18th of October in Irish cinemas. Kathleen, played by the great Hazel Doop, plays a lonely 18-year-old girl who gets out of the care system and moves into an old house that belonged to her mother. Her life is very empty. And then she meets Dee, played by Claire Dunne, a neighbour who has a husband and a child as well. And Kathleen really falls for her as a new friend, but because of Kathleen's previous life, it turns into something of an obsession, let's say. And she really struggles with this new friendship and wants more from it than maybe Claire Dunne's character is willing to give. Hazel Doop is absolutely fantastic in it. You may know her from Float Like a Butterfly. She's going to be in a series, ironically, she can say very little about, called Say Nothing, which is all about the Northern Troubles. This was written and directed by Eva Birthistle, who you probably know as the Bad Sister. She's not bad at all, but she's Ursula in Bad Sisters. She was in A Fond Kiss, The Last Kingdom. This is one of our great actresses, but this is her directorial debut. And so she directed it and wrote it. It stars Hazel Doop, who, as I say, is brilliant in it, conveying sadness, loneliness, confusion, very authentic performance. So I spoke to Eva Birthistle and Hazel Doop about Kathleen Is Here earlier in the week. Hazel, if I can start with you, there's a lot of sad moments in it. The saddest one, though, and I watched it with my wife, actually, who was nearly in tears, you'll be pleased to hear in terms of an effective emotion, is when your character is pretending with people she doesn't know on Facebook that she's having a drink with them. And it's heartbreaking. So, and there's lots of scenes like that, but that was the one in particular. So I wonder, like, I don't know, I know it's acting, but at the end of the day, or even at the start of the day, do you have to kind of go, okay, let's do this and steady ourselves?
That is so interesting, because I just spoke about that and how that was probably the toughest scene of the shoot, because, and not that it was particularly taxing in that I had to show so much, but just that for me as a person it was really, really tough to to imagine what that experience must be like alone. I think before that scene in particular, I think, see, Eva is amazing. And I wish you weren't here when I was saying all
that. Just that's a perfect line to end on.
I have some more time.
Yeah, no.
So Eva's amazing in that, like, the atmosphere that she creates on set is one of just total, total safety. She is your safety blanket. And obviously Kathleen doesn't have that in her life, but I really, really did that day, and it made it, and every day on set, we had a 20-day shoot and we had so much to shoot, and just every day felt like I was there and I wanted to be there and I didn't want to go home, and I really wanted to tell this story to whatever end.
Yeah, well, you did it very well. Eva, you know, Hazel talked about the safety on set, and I read this fascinating thing about you working with Ken Loach, and that set was the that's the way to do a set, kind of, because no one's shouting or get me my coffee or any of that stuff. It seems like you really wanted to ape that. I know it's your own movie, though.
Yeah, and he does a very specific way of working that, you know, sort of he shoots an order and you don't always get the script, and it's by no means trying to do that. But you're absolutely right. What was very striking about being on his set, and I carried with me and did want to try and ape, was just people liking each other, respecting each other, wanting to be at work, working hard, but also having a good time doing it. And, you know, it's not always the case. You can have really challenging days, and especially on a 20-day shoot when you're really up against it and you're shooting 6 pages a day and you're all the, you know, challenges of low-budget filmmaking. But at the end of the day, there's no reason to not be nice to somebody, you know? So it's just simply trying to maintain that.
You didn't need Ken Loach to tell you that. To be nice to people,
yeah. Yeah, I'll thank my mum and dad for that.
Yes, exactly. And tell me this, you know, the evolution of the story, this is your first time directing and writing a full-length movie. Did you always want to write a story and direct a movie about a lost child? Like, I gather it may have started out somewhere else, but was that the kind of the idea of a young girl in trouble? Was that the genesis?
Yes, that was sort of, it did start as that, not to do with the foster system. It was a bit of a different story. I seem to be, like, because I'm working on the next script as well, and sort of the stories that I'm drawn to are certainly thinking about writing. That seems to be the common theme or ground that I seem to be drawn to or wanting to explore, the sort of child-parent relationship, and the person on the, I'm sort of always interested in looking at the person who's on the outside looking in, and, you know, a person on the margins of society, and exploring those stories. So I'm definitely drawn towards that, and albeit this script changed over the years, it definitely started, it was still a young girl dealing with grief and dealing with isolation and loneliness. That was, you know, that was what interested me.
Yeah. And Hazel, your relationship with Claire Dunne is fascinating in it, and how she's introduced, and then your, without giving any spoilers, your obsession with her, let's say. And, like, on a 20-day shoot, that's, you know, that's short. So, you know, I keep reading about these chemistry tests and things like that, and Hollywood can go off and, you know, you can go to Hawaii for 6 months and get to know someone. I presume you didn't do that with Claire, but yet you're right in it. Like, did you have to do anything before you started to get that sense of mother and child, for want of a better phrase?
Well, I mean, the dynamic between myself and Claire is more, it's not mother and child, it's more like mates. And the obsession was already there for me, so it wasn't difficult to emulate that. But yeah, we had like 2 weeks, I think, to prep beforehand, did we? We had about 2 weeks, I think, of prep. And then we launched into it. And I think, I don't know how you did it, but you managed to find people that were just so directly on the same page as you for everything. So everyone, when they came together, just fell into step. And it was a very, very easy process, especially with Claire. Claire is incredible.
We had a great cast. You all had, I think, sort of similar, you know, views and ideas about how to work on set together. It was very natural collaboration, I think, you know.
Yeah. I'm sure all morning people are asking about Bad Sisters, and I realise you can't really talk about it. So, and this interview will be no exception. But if you can tell me the plot of every episode, how it ends.
How long have you got? It's about 10 seconds now.
No. But what I was wondering about was class in Bad Sisters.
Oh, Clay's Bang. Yeah.
Like, in the first season, the relationship he has with everyone is toxic, but with you and him, it's particularly, like, there's an episode named after him called The Prick. How hard is it to hate an actor like that on screen?
He did a very good job of being a prick on screen. He really embodied the character very, very well, but it was deliciously written, you know. Yeah. It's sort of, I mean, he was horrid, and but the scripts were so good. I think it was all there. But getting that casting right, of course, is everything. And yeah, I think they nailed it with Clay. So yeah, he did an incredible job. But we were able to, you know, laugh at him being a prick. there was a lot of fun around it as well, which is kind of very necessary.
I can imagine. And then Hazel, finally, you know, you know this better than anyone, but, like, someone said musicians and actors invented unemployment, right? They were the first people who were unemployed, which may not be true. And so many actors, even very famous ones that I've met, still have a sense of, you know, I'm still a working actor. I may not work for the next 6 months. And people like, not to name drop, but Colin Farrell and all sorts of people say that like, you know, I'm still a working actor. Do you have a sense now, because I keep reading about you and there are big projects ahead, some of which we can't even mention, say nothing at all. But I'm wondering, do you feel now like this is my job? I'm an actress or an actor?
Yeah, actually, it's funny. It's really funny how sudden that shift was, because someone told me a couple of years ago that it's when you reach the 10-year mark of having done it, not necessarily frequently, but just having done acting, that you sort of switch, and when someone asks you what you do for a living, you feel okay enough to say, I act for a living.
That's so true. It is 10 years. I was
it
10
literally
years
was
I could,
10 years. Yeah.
So are you at that point now? Can you say, I'm Hazel, I'm an actor?
Yeah, I think so. I get quite awkward at parties, but my friends sometimes have to say it for me. But I think so. It's been 13 years now, and I'm...
rather good at it.
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
Yeah. They keep employing you. So.
And you can now say you're a director as well, Eva. Right?
Yeah, but I suppose maybe it takes 10 years before I can actually say that without...
It's like an AA meeting.
I'm a director. Thank you.
I haven't had a movie in 6 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, Kathleen is here. It's fantastic. And great to see you both.
You too. Thank you so much.
Hazel Doop and Eva Berthisel there talking to me about Kathleen is Here, which is in cinemas from the 18th of October. A great watch. Up next, another great watch, Peter Coonan in King Frankie, a new Irish movie. He's in studio with me after the break. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now I want to tell you about a great new Irish movie that's opening this weekend called King Frankie. Following the death of his father, Frankie Burke, played by Peter Coonan, a kindly taxi driver living a quiet life in a Dublin suburb is forced to confront the ghost of his past when an unexpected stranger arrives at his door. 10 years earlier, Frankie was living a wildly extravagant life, losing money as quickly as he could make it, oblivious, or somewhat oblivious maybe, to the concerns of those around him who loved him, and particularly his own father's. But then matters come to a pretty, let's say, serious and maybe tragic head at a party that he's organised 10 years previously, we see this, in the throes of the economic crash for his 8-year-old daughter. And it's in a very elaborate hotel and smacks of Celtic tigerism. It's a terrific movie. It was written and directed by Dermot Malone, and as I say, stars Peter Coonan, who both join me in corporeal form, which is always nice. I'll figure out what corporeal means at some stage, in the building. Delighted to have them both here. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thank you.
Peter, it seems to me, you know, when we first meet your character, Frankie, he's very quiet. He's clearly a bit brittle. And when we meet him 10 years previously, or 11 years, whatever the maths is, he's probably a bit brittle, but he's very showy. He's out there. He's wearing a nice red suit. He's a bit in your face. It must be kind of a gift as an actor to like have that arc, to play that kaleidoscope of these two different people who are very much the same.
Yeah, it really was. That's what drew me to the project immediately when I got the script, and it was a daunting idea to take that on. But certainly as an actor, they're the kind of roles that you live for.
Yeah.
And I mean, you always kind of live for like a spy maybe as well. He was like, you're playing both sides, you know, DiCaprio in The Departed or something like that. But this was something that came along, and it was a right challenge. And, you know, it was so well thought out, the story. And obviously then when we spoke, myself and Dermot, we met, you know, Dermot was very open to my ideas in regards to, you know, how we can make both characters believable.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest kind of challenge in these scenarios.
Yeah.
That you don't want to make one character too extreme.
Yeah. A Scarface.
Yeah. Or another character too downtrodden, that you need to try and find a balance.
Yeah. Well, you pulled it off. Dermot, I don't want to do Dr. Freud here, but we're all, well, you're probably younger than me, but we both remember the financial crisis 15 years ago. I don't want to pry, but Why did you want to have this in it? Was there something that struck you about that time? Was it a family and friends thing, or did you just think it's a good setting for a story?
Yeah, I think for me, like, you know, I've always dreamt of making movies, and that old cliche goes like, you're right, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to find a story that I could tell, a story that I thought deserved to be told. This was just immediately what came to me, and I wanted to explore this, I guess, that time in Ireland and all of the trauma and hurt that came from that, and then I guess in a kind of a more hopeful way, the capacity for change. And I feel like, you know, it's even only in the last kind of week or two, like, we see what's going on with the bike shed and, you know, this budget and a free-for-all thing, and you're kind of getting this sense that, you know, Jesus, I hope this doesn't happen again. And it feels like almost like a cautionary tale in a way now. And yeah, it was just something that, you know, it's quite personal to me. I lived through a version of it, I guess.
Yeah.
And yeah, it felt like a good time to tell that story.
One of the things I like about the narrative is, or the story, we're not sure, and I don't want to give a spoiler, but we're not sure what Frankie's done or doing when we're seeing him now or in the past on that fateful day. But there's a whiff of he's transgressing the line into criminality, maybe, or maybe not. And then another character shows up and he's getting money off him, and it's clearly something, but it's vague. I presume you were clear you wanted it to a whiff of something.
Yeah, 100%. Again, like when I remember that time, and there was deals being done, and there was, you know, and it was just, be it a developer or, you know, small family business or whatever, it all seemed very in the shadows. It all seemed very like, well, I've got investment come from here, I've got that come from there. And maybe it's because I was young at the time, but there was never anything of substance, you know, and I kind of wanted that to feed into the story and let the audience kind of draw their own conclusions a little bit as well, you know.
Yeah. And Peter, just during the, this is about the movie, but I wonder what your sense of that time is in your life when you think back on 10, 15 years and 2009 and 2010 when Ireland seemed to be falling apart. Where were you at?
Yeah, I remember actually now for the first time, I remember being in the family home when Lehman Brothers news came out that they were on the way down. And I think a lot of my friends were thinking about leaving.
Yeah.
Or then left.
Left the country
yeah. in the preceding 6 to 12 months. Now I was here trying to, you know, get going in this job. But yeah. I remember things changing dramatically.
Mm.
And I suppose as well, I do remember stories a couple of years later of people who had very extreme experiences in the fallout of it,
yeah.
You know, people dying from suicide, yeah. and all the very tragic cases that happened that followed it. But as well, I was in college at the time, okay. So, you know, I wasn't really like working or anything like yeah. that. But you could definitely see, I remember, because I grew up in Leopardstown, and I remember the races on Stephen's Day, the helicopters that went over were 10 a dozen, like they were every couple of minutes, every year from the start of the week to the end of the week. And yeah, it was lavish.
Mm.
And the gear as well. I remember looking back in pictures because at the time when we were planning the costume and stuff, and you're looking back at some of the characters, and like, it was...
Well, it's funny, I mentioned the red suit. I thought the suit looked great on you, actually. Yeah. You do that suit well. But anyway, tell me this, in that, because I love the scenes, well, I love the whole movie, but I love the scenes in this fancy hotel where you're having this party that you clearly can't afford, or and you're finding it hard to get the deposit together to pay the Jobsworth who's looking for it. That building tension... like, is it just, well, I'm an actor, that's what I do? Or, like, do you have to work to, because it's writ large across your face, and you're, it reminded me a bit of that day in Goodfellas when he's chasing helicopters in the sky and the world's about to catch up with him, Ray Liotta's character. Mm. How do you get that tense?
Genie. I suppose it's written, and as well, I mean, I remember at the time...
Just read the page.
Yeah, but at the time, I remember saying to Dermot, like, going, he's coming in and out of rooms a lot, but
yeah.
also that was the kind of, that's the avoidance, the yeah. constant shaking people off. And, you know, normally this works because not everyone is in such close proximity to one another,
yeah.
but it's like that where everything's caving in on top of you, and every person you're trying to avoid, you're trying to avoid your parents at all costs in this scenario, because
yeah.
you know what you're doing is somewhat shameful,
yeah.
so you don't want to see them looking at you with yeah. that parental gaze that, you know, I know I'm doing something wrong. I kind of, the tension was around just bringing that energy to life and making it panicky. I think yeah. we had discussed the kind of, you know, what people were up to at the time. And we didn't want that in the film because we didn't want that to be so prevalent. But I think, you know, that energy definitely was there, even if it was being used or not.
And the thing about the rooms is very well done in it, that he's going from room to room, and maybe that's a metaphor or something.
Yeah.
But Dermot would know more than me because you wrote the thing.
Yeah.
Tell me this, it may sound like a trivial thing, but I love the party setting, and maybe it's a, you know, I'm not sure if you have children, Dermot, but...
One daughter.
There you go. Months, yeah. Sorry, I should have checked that. I really should have Googled that. But there's a brilliant scene where the clown who's hired for the party comes to Peter's character, Frankie, and he's like, listen, you know, I make a lot of money on the face paint, and you said there'd be more people there. And I've, as a father of three, been at a lot of parties, and I don't think I've ever had a row with a clown, but certainly people who've delivered bouncy castles have suffered my limited ire at times. And I just thought the setting and the tension of a children's party was a great setting. Have you skin in the game in terms of kids' parties going wrong?
Do you know what it was? I remember that time being like a kid and you know, having been exposed to that world and remembering parties that were bigger than any wedding I've ever been to.
Yeah.
And remembering archery and canoeing and all this ridiculous ostentatious stuff. And then the clown just kind of grew as a character. The clown is played by Fergus Tilly, who's one of my best mates. And it started off by just being kind of a visual, you know, I guess, motif in the film.
Yeah.
Kind of trying to say something about what these people are and how they're behaving and stuff. And then, you know, I was just always trying to find other devices to poke at Frankie all the time. I was like, what would be interesting here? Let's get the clown to tap him up as well as everyone else and put him under more pressure. So, I love that scene, actually. Yeah.
Owen Rowe plays the dad. He's such a dad figure. You know, he's every man's dad. And the love he has for Frankie's gorgeous in it because he just wants the best for him. And he's getting the whiff, I think. But again, you know more about it than I do. Was he always in your head? He's the dad?
Yeah, I think Owen and Peter both, like, you know, are actors that I've watched throughout my whole kind of, I guess, education as someone who wants to, I guess, be an artist. And yeah, I mean, Owen has such gravitas. Owen has such, even if he's not in a huge amount of scenes in the film, you know, every time he's on screen, he's just magnetic and you're drawn to him, and he has such presence and such authority, quiet authority. It was hard to look past him. Again, the same goes for Pete. Like, it's even reading reviews and getting reactions to the film, like, all anyone is talking about, and rightly so, is the work that Peter does in the film. Again, to have the opportunity to work with two of the best actors this country has ever had was it was pretty special.
High praise indeed. Tell me this before I go back to Peter. I should have Googled it. Sorry, I've had a busy morning, as I told you before. But the song at the end about the blue eye is absolutely gorgeous. Who sings that?
We'll go back to Peter then. Because that was actually, it was interesting. We shot.
Peter's not singing it, is
he? No, Peter's not singing it. It's Ye Vagabonds.
Ye Vagabonds.
Yeah. And Blue is the Eye.
Blue is the Eye.
On set, I think it was on the first week or the second week on set. The
first week of Frankie Sr.
Yeah, first week of 2019. And Pete was listening to Ye Vagabonds. He's a big fan and was kind of like encouraging me to listen to them. And that song just blew me away. And it kind of became an anthem for the film. And then throughout the edit process, I was like, oh, do you know what? Let's see how this works. And now it's just synonymous with the film. I can't imagine it. It's a character within itself.
Absolutely. And it kind of nearly moves the story on in some ways.
It's big time.
Brilliant use of it. Brilliant use of it. Peter, as it happens, I'm talking to Eva Birtthistle and Hazel Doop on the show this week for another movie you're in called Kathleen Is Here, which you were also great in. It's a smaller part, but you play dad in that. But it just seems, you know, two movies in 1 week since you've been out of college and all that, we've seen you a lot. Do you have a sense now that you've kind of, does one ever arrive, but you're busy?
Well, I was just going to say that with two films coming out a week apart from each other, people would think you are busy. No. I am busy. I mean, this is the thing. I'm getting to do great work. Now, there's obviously going to be gaps in between in this job, but I am beginning to enjoy the gaps and also beginning to kind of see the breaks as times to, you know, go watch movies myself, go obviously look after my three kids, but also, you know, take a walk around, go to a gallery, have time to read a paper or read a book, catch up, because this is actually, you know, perfect ground to then prepare for something else, because I just feel at times that, you know, people in such a busy society we live in, you know, I always think for a long number of years I used to think, oh God, I'm not doing anything.
Yeah.
I mean, but then now as I've gotten older, I've gone, you actually, like, not doing something as a performer, actor, artist, whatever, is actually part of your job.
Okay, so to in your soak it up. Downtime, you're kind of feeding that thing that you'll bring to set, maybe?
I think you have to. I think it's just like just watching movies, walking around, you know, enjoying nature, reading poetry,
being
whatever
a dad.
The hell, being a dad, doing stuff that I wouldn't do before, and I'd panic about my next job, where now I'm like, this free time can be used to kind of soak up the atmosphere and then be prepared if something comes along.
And tell me this, is it your earnest hope that with all these good roles, people like me will stop asking about Love Hate?
No, because I heard this morning, because I'm glad I'm not the only one, because I heard this morning that Tom Von Lawler has been cast in a wonderful spy series with Michael Fassbender.
Right.
Which, you know, as an actor, is such a, and he's such a remarkable performer anyway.
Yeah.
But for him and for anyone is such a such a monumentous moment. But still, in Ireland, it's, and he's a spy on the opposite side working for the government or whatever, and it's Spy Nidgee or something. Is in the paper. So, you know what I mean? So I don't think we're going to get away from it, but it's not something I would ever want to get away from, because I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if it wasn't for Love Hate.
Absolutely. And at no point did I refer to you as Fran, nor would I. I shouldn't have even mentioned it. It's like Macbeth, you know? Dermot, finally then, I just noticed in the credits, and again, I should have Googled it, but you can ask the people in front of you, a couple of Malones as producers. Are they family or just a happy accident?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of the executive producers who kind of supported the film, be it either financially or emotionally or through you know, helping out or through making sandwiches or whatever it is. I wanted to recognise anyone who's ever kind of contributed to my own journey and getting this film made in some way and put their name in lights and that. So yeah, that's my dad.
That's a lovely thing to do. Well, listen, King Frankie is great. And I said to you beforehand, I said yes before I watched it because I wanted to talk to you. But it's great. And it's getting a cinema release, which is very important, on the 11th of October. So please go and see it in a cinema. I've been talking to its star, Peter Coonan, and its director and writer, Dermot Malone. Thanks a million for coming in,
lads. Thanks so much for the time. Really appreciate it.
Peter Coonan and Dermot Malone, they're talking to me about King Frankie, which is in cinemas, as we said, from this Friday, the 11th of October. Up next, the return of the Transformers. Do we really need it? Let's find out. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. We turn to the week's other new cinema releases. The big new release of the week is probably Transformers 1. Wait for it, folks. A Transformer origin story. Good heavens. And a movie that is literally terrifying people to the point of walkouts and apparently vomiting in one case. Terrifier 3, a Christmas slasher movie. To make sense of all of this, I'm joined by, let's just call him, movie buff to beat all movie buffs, Brian Lloyd. Brian, how are you?
That's a big intro. I don't know if I can beat that, but okay, fair enough.
Let's see how the next 10 minutes go, all right?
We'll give it a shot.
So listen, Transformers 1, it's like, a part of me is like, come on, man.
Yeah.
Like, have we not, like, an origin story for Transformers? But it turns out I may be wrong. This is an animated movie that seems to be harking back to, you know, I'm a bit older than you, but the 80s, I remember those cartoons.
Yeah.
And people are saying this is kind of that ilk and it's not that bad. But you tell me.
No, yeah, you know, you're 100% right. I mean, this is the thing about this. As I was watching this, and I really did enjoy it, you know, I was thinking to myself, God, they should have made this years ago. Why didn't they do this instead of doing those terrible Michael Bay films? You know what I mean? Like, this feels just much more natural and much more in keeping with the kind of the tone and the ethos of it. So it's directed by Josh Cooley, who people would know. He directed How to Train Your Dragon, which was this great animated adventure franchise that DreamWorks did. And Transformers 1 has a similar vibe in that it looks gorgeous. It's really, really a beautifully visually put together film. But it also has like a great amount of, you know, really well-designed action set pieces, you know. And that's obviously what you want in Transformers. You want the idea of, you know, robots kicking the snot out of each other and, you know, that great kind of almost prog rock glam metal soundtrack to go along with it as well. But
the other guy, Megatron, they're kind of pals, is that it?
Yeah, so it's essentially how they, it's sort of like how they became, you know, brothers to enemies, you know. Before he was Optimus Prime, he was called Orion Pax, and before he was Megatron, I think he was called D-17, but they're voiced by Chris Hemsworth and Brian Tyree Henry, respectively. And you also have Scarlett Johansson in there, who plays sort of like the one lone female Transformer. But even like the other kind of the supporting cast is fantastic as well. Like you have John Hamm, the great John Hamm from Mad Men, voicing this sort of like kind of, you know, American president, all-American Transformer called Sentinel Prime. Steve Buscemi voices the great Starscream, who was, you know, if you ever watched the old TV series, like he was sort of Megatron's second in command that was always trying to kind of get one over on him. And the personalities of the actors really shines through. It's not just this thing of, lol, let's just get a famous person and see what happens. Like, no, they've actually put some real thought into why they're getting that particular actor to voice it. Like in the case of Chris Hemsworth, you know, he's a little bit unsure of himself, but he's got a kind of a cockiness to it. That's, you know, that sort of bravado, which, you know, Taika Waititi tapped into really well with Thor Ragnarok. In the case of Brian Tyree Henry, you know, it's that thing of his voice has such resonance that, yes, it can be like warm and soft and kind of comforting, but then in an instant it can turn dark and turn really kind of like, you know, booming, almost that sort of James Earl Jones kind of thing. And in the case of Steve Buscemi, you know, like Starscream is this sort of weaselly, you know, angry kind of character, yet Buscemi is able to kind of present that in such a way that it's not nasally and annoying. And even John Hamm as well, him playing this, like, again, all-American Superman type of character, but there's a hint of malice underneath it. So, yeah, it was great. I really enjoyed it.
Very well chosen voice cast. And then I mentioned just at the start that they're pals, and but it's how they become enemies or whatever. But they're kind of worker bees, are they? Or something along those lines?
Exactly. Yeah, they're basically working to mine Cybertron, which is the planet that they're on. And in order to do so, in order to kind of create all the Energon, which is the energy source for Cybertron, so that Sentinel Prime, John Hamm's character, can go to the surface and defeat the bad aliens. But as you would know, it turns out that there's actually much more to it than meets the eye, which is the tagline of it. But there's a real kind of like Metropolis-y vibe to it, in the idea of like this massive city, the idea of worker bees, the idea of, you know, a class system in place and how we kind of venerate people in order for us to feel better about ourselves and stuff like that. But again, like, I mean, look, this is all sort of subtext. Like, you can see that there if you want to look for it, but the rest of the time, like, it's this really kind of pop art influenced, really kind of vibrant action adventure kind of thing. But again, you know, the thing I kept coming back to was like, why didn't they do this 20 years ago? Why didn't they do this 10 years ago? This is how it should have been. It shouldn't have, like, live action is so stupid for Transformers, you know, like it just, it's so limiting. Whereas this, it makes sense. Like,
yeah. And is Bumblebee in this?
Bumblebee is in this. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The character from the original ones and then from the spin-off movie as well is in it. And he's voiced by Keegan-Michael Key, who again, you know, great comedic actor, great choice for it. Lawrence Fishburne is in there as well. He plays this character called Alpha Trion. Bumblebee is in it. And it's actually funny as well, like, of the live-action films, I mean, far and away, Bumblebee was the best out of them all. And I think what Travis Knight understood was that, you know, when it comes to Transformers and stuff like that, believe it or not, less is more. You don't need to go hell for leather. You don't need this kind of maximalist approach, which Michael Bay was famous for. It can be kind of subtle. And in the case of Bumblebee, like, it was very much sort of going for, you know, 80s inspired kind of thing, like, you know, like Short Circuit or... Yeah. You know, the Goonies even.
Yeah, I mean, the Gremlins or something like that.
Those kind of great Joe Dante, you know, special effects, but with a practical edge to it. And in the case of Transformers 1, this was more kind of like almost early Pixar, you know, that kind of way. The animation was a little bit simplistic, but that's okay. Like, there's a lot of color to it. There's a lot of vibrancy to it. And that kind of less is more approach works for it, you know?
Yeah. So listen, tell me stars, and en route to that, you can double up the answer here. If I'm going to take my six-year-old to this on the weekend, as I may well do, he's going to enjoy it and I'm going to enjoy it?
100%. Like, I'll give this like an 8 out of 10. This is like the best Transformers film I've seen in years.
You're messing with my star system. I do three. I do five stars. So what are you going to do stars-wise?
Okay, I'll go four out of five. Like, this is a
four practice. Out of five.
Yeah.
Don't ever mess with the star rating system.
I apologize. I know how important star systems are. I apologize.
Yeah, you know, you sound like Optimus Prime, not getting the whole worker bee thing here. Anyway, so that is 4 out of 5 stars for Transformers 1 from Blowing Light. Let's take a quick clip.
Listen to me. I really want you to hear this. Are you listening? I'm better than you.
Yeah, okay, I'm hearing you.
I'm better than you in every way, except you have hope. You always have. You went back into the mine to rescue Jazz. You snuck up to the surface to find the Matrix of Leadership.
Yeah, and how'd that work out?
My point is that your instincts tell you to break protocol for a reason. This blind optimism that you have is why you make such bold and courageous choices that are also extremely stupid.
That's a clip there from Transformers, and you heard some of the great voice cast there. It does sound very good, actually, I have to say. And Brian Lloyd gave it 4 out of 5 stars. Now, Brian, this is kind of bizarre stuff. So I was vaguely aware of the two previous Terrifier movies. Opening in cinemas this weekend is Terrifier 3. As I mentioned in the intro, there's been walkouts in the UK at some film festival like this. Someone supposedly vomited. This is a slasher movie set at Christmas in the third iteration.
It is, yeah. It's kind of harking back to, again, going back to the 80s, the video nasty phenomenon, if you're familiar with that, where there were these like really gory, just over-the-top exploitation horrors. Terrifier and the third one is very much in keeping with that. It follows Art the Clown, who is this psychopathic, supernaturally tinged serial killer that's dressed up like a clown. I really have to be honest. I stopped watching this after half an hour because, you know, like, obviously, you know, violence and horror goes hand in hand. And, you know, the more extreme and all the rest of it, the more over the top it is, the more it's likely to kind of encounter a visceral reaction. And I read those articles about people walking out after the first 5 minutes. I will say the first 5 minutes is absolutely brutal. And there's a level of violence to it that I haven't seen in years. And it goes even into violence against children. And I'm not going to go into details with it, but suffice it to say, the first 5 minutes is absolutely brutal. And that kind of like splatter gore kind of thing, you know, it's the kind of thing where it's violent and sickening for its own sake. It doesn't really have a substance to it. And speaking of substance, you look at like that film, The Substance, there, you know, the horror and the violence and the gore and all the rest of it, it has a point. It's rooted in a reason. There's an artistic intent behind it. Whereas something like Terrifier 3 and Terrifier 2 and the first one, it's just gore for its own sake, and it just has shock value. And that in itself is just cheap and boring. And just, you know, when you're hammered in the face with it again and again and again, it just becomes grim and miserable. And you're just like, oh, I can't sit through more of this. There's nothing going on here. I mean, the actors in it are terrible. You've got Chris Jericho in there, who has an extended cameo as this orderly that gets his head ripped open. And, you know, unless you are a big, big gore hound, unless, you know, Cannibal Holocaust, Hostel, all these films, if that's your bag, then yeah, sure, go and enjoy Terrifier 3. But I think for the person who has, you know, a casual interest in horror, this is absolutely not the thing to go see. Like, it's brutal in a way that I haven't seen in years.
You know, I don't think I ever actually saw one, but I do remember videos from a van and the video nasty thing. And actually, there's a great movie from 2 years ago aping all that called Censor, which is a fantastic look. But in a way, it sounds like all this movie is trying to do is do a video nasty.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, and like, there is, you know, that's fertile ground, you know, that kind of way. Like, I mean, there is, you know, horror does have an underground punk element to it. And that's what those video nasties had. And this is the same thing. It is trying to kind of, you know, shock value, you know, gore for its own sake. Mm. You know, really upsetting and stuff like that. Like the UK premiere of it, you know, they were handing out sick bags with the Terrifier 3 logo on it and stuff like that. Like, and you know, it feeds itself, you know, that kind of way. It feeds its own mystique, it feeds its own cult status. And mm-hmm. you know, video nasties, like, you know, you think back to, you know, David Cronenberg and The Brood and stuff like that, or The Fly, for example. Like, they were violent, they were gory, but there was an art to it. There was a reason behind it, even if you couldn't see it, even if you did have to dig through a lot of layers. With Terrifier 3, I don't think it's there. I don't think there's anything really yeah. underneath it, you know?
And you stopped after half an hour.
I was like, I don't need to see yeah, any more of this. Yeah. I know where this is going. Like,
yeah, you know, as well, if I'm completely honest about it, and maybe this isn't as philosophically sound as it should be, but I would always defend people's right to make art if they see it that way for its yeah. own sake. But, you know, to misquote Dante, there is a special place in hell for people who hurt children. So yeah. if there is any whiff of that, of anything, I'm not watching it. And I know a million people more who wouldn't either. So I think we should just consign this one to the do not watch from my point of view. And I haven't even seen it, but I trust you. So if you had to give this piece of trash a star rating, what would it be?
Like, I mean,
for the 30 minutes of it you watched.
For the 30 minutes of watch, I mean, I'll give it a 2 out of 5. I mean, okay, I appreciate the practical effects that were used and stuff like that. I appreciate the fact that it's got, you know, it's an homage to a certain blend of horror that you don't really see anymore. But, I mean, it's poorly acted. It's very, very grim. It's a lot to take. Yeah.
I think you're being very generous with 2 stars. Sounds like it's 1 or possibly a 0. Well, thank you for suffering half an hour of that. We are definitively saying avoid Terrifier 3. That's my takeaway. But for something much more wholesome and surprisingly entertaining, Transformers 1, which Brian Lloyd gave 4 stars. Brian, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Brian Lloyd there talking to me about a pretty horrific sounding movie called Terrifier 3, which I made my feelings pretty known about there, and also Transformers 1, which seems to be a pleasing movie. Go figure. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to Christopher Reeve's 3 children about a fantastic new documentary and a very sad one all about his life. I'll also be talking to Aidan Turner and indeed Victoria Smurfit about the new series on Disney, Rivals. All of that to come next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and have a safe week ahead.